Soon he began to make friends. One of these friends was Russell Hatchett, then city manager of Virginia Beach. To him and many others, Casey made his predictions of the tiny town's astounding growth. Nobody believed it at first, because the town was building south, and Casey said it would be moving north. The city manager looked at him in disbelief. Later, as the land development process reversed itself, he reversed his opinion of Casey. I was amazed with Casey's vision regarding the values in this area, that he should have been able to hit the turnabout with its spectacular rise in values. Property to the North End has advanced in price some 10 times what it was at the time that Casey made his prediction. And this, some 35 years ago. The prices have been soaring ever since. It didn't hurt any that the East Coast's largest naval base was at neighboring Norfolk, the port embracing a wider area known as Hampton Roads. Casey had predicted, within the next 30 years, Norfolk, with its environs, is to be the chief port on the East Coast, not excepting Philadelphia or New York. Casey sensed the indecision of some prospective homeowners. Because of his confidence in the city's growth, he urged many to make their buys before the property got away from them. The prices were rising so fast that even a month's delay might be costly. Respecting the acquiring of a home as indicated, you will find there is a 25 to 50% advance already in the properties, whether it be a farm or a home, that might have aided in preparing the way for a good life. The sooner the decision, the better. And do prepare, wherever it may be, so if it comes to the worst, you can sit down and grow something to eat. You won't be hungry if you are wise and make preparations. Though he didn't speculate in local real estate and become a millionaire like so many of his devotees, Casey did manage to buy a pleasant house to the south. Prices there were so much cheaper that even he could afford a place with a garden of beautiful flowers that he talked to, and a small pond to the rear of the house. He invited a house guest, a friend of his son Hugh Lynn, but warned if he didn't come early, he wouldn't recognize the neighborhood. Most of the little frame buildings along 17th Street have been torn away or are being torn away. They are being replaced with brick, and we're putting on the air of a real city. And the dwellings, goodness, you can't look anywhere without seeing new places going up. He had seen the whole Virginia Tidewater area prospering, including the cities of Norfolk, Newport News, Hampton, and Portsmouth, which comprised the port area known as Hampton Roads. He saw this age of the millennium as very special because of his expectations of Christ's presence, emphasizing the presence and not the person. He foretold that Jesus would make himself known in his own way, echoing the biblical references in the New Testament. Believing in reincarnation, Casey expected to be around for the occasion in one form or another. Virginia Beach had no more than 20,000 people when Casey arrived with his wife and 2 small children. People came to him with every imaginable problem as his reputation spread. They inquired about their health, about business, the stock market, and jobs. Some looked at him doubtfully when he suggested they buy homes to the north when the town was building up to the south. Nobody knowing the construction of a bay tunnel bridge to the north would eventually transform the modest little resort into the largest city in Virginia with almost 500,000 people. A millennial event Casey had foreseen. When Virginia Beach had no more than 30,000 people, a Casey friend related, he told me to buy a couple of properties for $5,000. I asked why he didn't buy it if it was going up 50 times or more, as he said. He laughed, kind of wryly, and said he couldn't do it even if he had the money, as profiting from what he did would diminish what he was trying to do, which was helping others, not himself. He was strong on this brotherhood business, saying people had to think of their fellow man more, or they'd stir up all the adverse elements like earthquakes and volcanoes and tidal storms. It sounded a little far-fetched to me, but I gave it a little more credibility when land values soared in the areas he specified, as if there was no ceiling to them. It took a few years, but I held on, and eventually the land was worth $500,000. Land was going up like this all over the place, always to the north. I wanted to do something for Casey, but he wouldn't take anything from me. Only the $20 he got for a reading. And if people didn't have the money, that was all right, too. A few years after Casey had settled in the Beach City, he wrote, "To think that the readings told me years ago that this was the place to move to. Had I invested $500 in real estate here, from the profits today on that $500, I would have been able to fulfill my dream of building a library and teaching center with the $200,000 I would have had. However, it will come in time, if the good Lord wishes." And it did, eventually, along with a hospital, from the donations of grateful millionaires for Casey's non-profit projects. Even after Casey had passed on, he was making millions for people who followed his readings and took a plunge in property he had recommended. He was very high on the city in Virginia that his universal mind had led him to. Without elaborating, he often said it was the safest city on the East Coast. He was the local real estate man's best friend. Asked while in trance about the future of Virginia Beach, he replied, "This, as we find, would require a great deal of speculation on the part of individuals. As we would find, and as we give, of all the resorts that are on the East Coast, Virginia Beach will be the first and the longest lasting of the increasing of the population, valuation, and activities. Hence, the future is good." The author himself saw how the boom worked, long after Casey's passing, when friends asked him to join them in acquiring a 200-acre tract plum in the area where Casey's reading said prices would burgeon. The author could have easily obtained a $28,000 bank loan for the one-third interest in the property. They were well-meaning friends, John Smith, a pioneer builder of Virginia Beach hotels and an early supporter of Casey, and John's wife, Virginia. They took Jess Stern over the wooded land in an impressive tour. While he admired the landscape and saw its possibilities, the author's interests were in California, where he lived. But John and Virginia were old friends, so the author said, "If you need the money to close the deal, I will gladly come in with you." They smiled and shook their heads. "No, we just thought that Casey would like you to profit with us from wherever he's marking time. You forget, you wrote The Sleeping Prophet, the book that gave him new life." Jess Stern gave them a quizzical look. "So you think he's still around?" "Oh, yes. He'll be back for the millennium." A few years later, John passed on. The author attended his services and spent some time with Virginia in her bereavement. Eventually, she settled the estate. The property had not been mentioned in the intervening years, and the author had forgotten it completely. Virginia looked strained. She had just come from her lawyer's. She sighed as she looked at Stern across the luncheon table. "How I miss John." There was a mist in her eyes. "I never had to think about any business. John was so efficient, and he loved Edgar Casey so." The name had come out of nowhere. Suddenly her face brightened. "Do you remember the property John wanted to share with you?" The author thought a moment. "Vaguely." She had an impish look. "You'll never guess what it's worth today." Stern was very aware of the spiral of prices for residential land in Virginia Beach. "I hope you get a good price." She hesitated a moment, as though she wished she hadn't said anything. "You can get it out," the author said. "I know what's happening." She made a little face. "All right. Your $28,000 would now be worth $2.5 million. Stern was not surprised. Everybody in Virginia Beach who knew about Casey was getting rich, but Casey and him, it seemed. Stern reached for Virginia's hand. She was a dear friend. All I can say is, I'm glad you got it. And he was. The author wouldn't have known what to do with all that money. Journalists and writers of books were seldom millionaires, unless they listened to Casey. Laskin Road in downtown Virginia Beach became one of the principal shopping and business centers. But the developer, Jacob Laskin, unfortunately for him, knew nothing of Edgar Casey or his predictions, and probably wouldn't have listened had he heard. For Virginia Beach was a close-minded city then, happy about its small and neighborly context, and indifferent to outsiders. Years after the Laskins left the street that was named for them, Gladys Davis, Casey's secretary and aide, met Jacob Laskin's son while visiting in California. When she told him about the explosive growth of the street they had built, he said rather ruefully, "I guess we should have held out longer." They might have, had they known there was an Edgar Casey who was on top of the real estate market, like he was just about everything else. Casey was a wonder with anything financial. Wall Street brokers heard of his penchant for picking winners and prodded him for information on stocks, promising him a bonanza. He rejected the offers, but later met a businessman interested in financing the hospital Casey dreamed of, staffed with friendly doctors and nurses. With a hospital for the sick and disabled as a goal, Casey had no qualms about making money. "I can see," he told his wife Gertrude, "where the ends may justify the means." He wouldn't be doing it for himself, but for others. Gertrude wasn't so sure, but she, too, thought of all the good that could come of it. Wall Street was booming. You could punch a pin through the stock tables and come up a winner. Everything was going up, even as cracks were quietly beginning to appear in the economy. Soon, with a rising market, there was enough money to build the hospital on the Edgar Casey Foundation grounds overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. Casey's dream had come true. The year was 1929, and Casey's readings showed a growing concern with the economy. He began to advise his benefactors to withdraw gradually from the market, contenting themselves with the profits already given them. As the fall neared, his advice on getting out of the market grew more urgent, but the speculators had amassed a fortune so easily that they thought it was no time to get off the gravy train. Casey warned that a break was coming on Wall Street that would affect the whole country. There would be a panic in Wall Street, and the banks would close. The economy would be paralyzed. But the speculators weren't intimidated. Casey had to be wrong this time. Greed won out, and the speculators lost a fortune. The hospital was closed, and Casey's dream was shattered. Typically, he blamed himself. It was the last time he participated in any project where he would be a beneficiary. Nor would he knowingly give a reading for the object of making money. However, the forces of greed were everywhere, including his own family, where his father, a failure as a farmer and a storekeeper, lulled Edgar into a secret relationship with a Yankee doctor, Wesley Ketchum. The sole object, ostensibly, was to heal the sick, unable to find help with more conventional medicine. Casey felt comfortable with the relationship in the beginning. He would make the diagnosis in his sleep, suggest a remedy, and Ketchum would oversee the convalescence or perform whatever surgery that was required. In time, as his gift was misused for financial reasons, Casey, as he had been warned by his wife, suffered severe headaches, feeling dazed and shaken. He had no recall of what he was being asked in the unconscious state. Meanwhile, as the incurably ill began to get well, Ketchum, previously ostracized by Southerners still fighting the Civil War, prospered, as did Casey's father, who had masterminded the partnership. Ketchum justified his deception with the comforting assurance that he was saving lives in the process. Casey's father said the same, and he lost his son's confidence. The partnership remained pretty much a mystery until Hugh Lynn Casey, the mystic's son and new head of the foundation after his father's death, looked up Ketchum's wife in a small town near Los Angeles. He asked Jess Stern to join him, and they visited the 98-year-old Mrs. Ketchum together. She was sharp and alert, and her eyes brightened whenever she mentioned her husband's name. "Were you aware," Hugh Lynn asked, "that your husband gambled on the horse races from tips given him by Edgar Casey in his sleep?" The bright eyes twinkled. "All I know," she said with a smile, "was that my husband had the biggest racing stable in the state of Kentucky." Chapter 4, The Pole Shift and More. The Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, of Doom and Gloom, the Alarmists, are at it again. The world they see, or profess to see, is heading in a collision course to extinction. When that old polar axis goes into its dance, Siberia is going to become India, and India is going to wind up in South Africa, and South America and the United States may have a merger, or something like that. It has all happened before. Then what are we doing here? And it will all happen again, almost any day now, though no one is sure of the exact time. And Casey is saying quite the opposite. We have El Nino and global warming, and they've already arrived. So we don't have to speculate what they're going to do to us. They've already been busy off the coast of our neighbor to the south, Mexico, in Acapulco, Indonesia, and elsewhere. And that's something we can understand and sympathize with, and see how we will deal with it ourselves, in as practical a way as we know how. But glacial ice packs, 300-mile-an-hour winds, and huge mastodons and mammoths turned into oil deposits by floods that swept mountains away? That's something else again. What can we do about all this but examine what Edgar Casey has to say about our prospects? He's visualized a lot of hell and damnation before. Earthquakes to blast cities off the map and tides that will overwhelm the flatlands of various countries. So he's not the prophet, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, to hold back when people are sitting on the edge of their chairs with all those scientists and psychics salivating over the destruction they see with their dark glasses. Casey had a number of things to say about pole shifts. He was asked about them by scores of concerned people, some of them scientists, way back in 1939, namely about a pole shift he had predicted. "Will it, the shift, cause a sudden convolution, and about what year?" The sleeping prophet replied in his sleep. "In 1998, we may find a great deal of the activities, as have been wrought by the gradual changes that are coming about during this change between the Piscean and the Aquarian age. This is a gradual, not a cataclysmic activity in the experience of the Earth in this period." 5 years earlier, Casey was a little more explicit in a reading that caught Jess Stern's attention because of devastating volcanic eruptions on the island of Montserrat in the torrid Caribbean Sea. Eruptions predicted by him in oblique fashion. "As to the physical changes, there will be upheavals in the Arctic and the Antarctic that will make for eruptions of volcanoes in the torrid areas, and there will then be the shifting of the pole, so that where there has been those of a frigid or the semi-tropical will become the more tropical, and moss and fern will grow. And these will begin in those periods 58 to 98, when his light will be seen in the clouds." Late in 1997, as the author wrote this, global warming, believed to be caused by sunspots caused by a polar shift, was being blamed for bringing about droughts drying up masses of land in the torrid zones around the world. Casey had put a start on the polar shift, which others had speculated about. But he did not see it as catastrophic or cataclysmic, as many geologists and other self-styled experts did. In a 5-year lapse between 2 readings mentioning polar shifts, there had been a number of earthquakes and sizable storms around the world, but nothing of a catastrophic nature. What Casey saw in 1939, he saw again for the millennium's dawning. He was asked what great change or beginning of change, if any, was to take place in the Earth in the year 2000 to 2001. He replied simply, "When there is a shifting of the poles, or a new spiritual cycle begins." He saw the shift in stages, without any reason for alarm. A humanist above everything else, Casey was aware that the turning of the axis, as he put it, had an effect on the Earth's magnetic field, which, with the active sunspots, affected the climate in varying degrees. But his emphasis on gradual changes from a shifting pole was a clear indication that he didn't anticipate any catastrophic surprises. There were no warnings, with which he often couched his dire predictions, only a suggestion for man to mend his ways and live by the word of the Lord. Comparing this country with Atlantis, he mentioned a vastly different pole shift for someone with an incarnation in that distant civilization, relating to its storied past. Speaking of the Atlanteans' problems with 80-ton dinosaurs overrunning the country, he touched on the plans to exterminate the monstrous beasts with a death ray when the people got help elsewhere, from a natural source that appeared to be heaven-sent. A polar shift exterminating the animals before the Atlanteans could use any nuclear force. The entity, the subject listening spellbound, was then among those who were gathered to rid the earth of the enormous animals which overran the earth by shifting masses of ice. Nature God moved the poles in such a way that the animals were destroyed. To Casey, the entity was not only the physical presence of a person, but his spiritual essence carried over from a previous life that Casey was now outlining. The man listening, according to Casey, had been an Atlantean in a past existence, and his subconscious mind revived at this time memories of ages and places long forgotten. Memorable for him, but just another incident in the life of America's greatest seer. It was characteristic of Casey that he brought God into the situation, sanctifying the massacre of the huge animals without a clue to human life was spared in what must have been an earth-shaking incident. What Casey sensed in his sleep, the leading seismologists and astronomers have been losing sleep over. A Caltech seismologist noted plausibly, "The natural forces that shape our destinies are working slowly but inexorably under the earth, out of sight, unnoticed, setting off reactions and counter-reactions in fragile earth faults deep in the bowels of the earth. We have no way of knowing when the next quake will strike." Casey talked of a 1998 shift in the Earth's axis, ushering in the Aquarian Age, which may precipitate modest changes in the Earth's climate. Scientists agree that changes may have already been caused by the resulting weakening of the magnetic field that shields the Earth from solar winds and cosmic rays, already raising worldwide temperatures and reducing the ozone layer, which protects us from an excess of ultraviolet rays. Skin cancer is on the rise, with more than 1/4 of the adult population in the U.S. Sun Belt affected, and down under Australia restricting its beaches in the summer months. Dr. Keith McDonald, a research physicist at the U.S. Department of Commerce, involuntarily supported Casey's predictions, saying that the slippage of the Earth's axis engendered enough heat to gradually affect the protective magnetic field and its ozone layer. Casey maintained a positive attitude, saying that with the Earth changes, there comes a corresponding challenge in people's lives, making them aware of the God who holds their lives in His hands. Without the Lord, life at best is tenuous. Yet with all the hardships that accompany the natural changes wrought by the shifting of the poles, the quakes, the hurricanes, and the ocean tides, an optimistic Casey assures us that humanity will recover from its climactic trials and tribulations with a new consciousness of its connection to its Maker. He will not give us more than we can endure, Casey stressed. Whatever comes, as we look into our deepest self, he will give us the strength to work toward a brave new world that begins with us. For we cannot say often enough that just as we handle our daily lives, as we treat our fellow man, so shall we create the elements in nature that bring serenity out of turmoil and peace out of war. Man may forget, but God remembers. Not to punish, but to live in his image, as he has said. It is all up to us equally, for no man is greater than another in the Lord's eyes. As the shifting of the axis goes on, we can all be heartened, knowing it is a prelude to the bright new world, the dawn of a more creative age, the Aquarian age. Man entering into a partnership with the universe, using the energy from the sun and other planets, notably Jupiter with its cosmic rays, to clear the atmosphere, just as it clears his head of negativity and teaches that forgiving is forgiving, as the Lord forgives. Again and again, Casey stressed we can stand up to whatever comes, which he accented will not be that difficult. We will find we have a new friend in Mother Earth, knowing that what we do affects the Earth just as the Earth puts demands on us. Whether the hearts and minds of individuals or souls, given authority concerning the laws of the universe, are fired with the thoughts of dire consequences, or rather a spiritual awakening, then there is an awareness of that which is in the making in the affairs of the nation and the universe, in relation to Mother Earth. Casey saw life as a testing ground, with the Lord fixing the playing field and making the rules, yet ready to help if man responded to his first commandment, whatever the conditions. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, and thy neighbor as thyself. Many were impatient with Casey's piety at a time when they were pressed to keep their lives together, not realizing, as Casey knew so well, that what was inside a person ruled what was outside, whether it was an earthquake, flood, or fire, or a depression and the absence of love. So live each day, each hour, in the spirit of truth and faith in the Lord, so as to practice those influences in your own life and the life of all you contact. For the Lord has said, though you wander far afield, if you will cry unto me, if you will ask, if you will draw nigh unto you, my arm is not short as man's counting of shortness, but will bring you to that which is the desire of your heart, if conceived in righteousness. Ironically, while the scientific community viewed Casey and his witchcraft with tolerant smiles, plain common sense brought many scientists unwittingly into his camp. The climate reality is that if you look out your window, part of what you see in terms of weather is produced by ourselves, noted Thomas Carl, the lead scientist at the National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina. If you look out the window 50 years from now, we're going to be responsible for more of it. Carl blames this part of the warming globe on a world fueled by greenhouse gases, principally carbon dioxide, produced by the burning of coal, oil, and natural gases. Unlike Casey, Carl doesn't get into the cause of this aberration, man's greed. In some areas, like California's coastal waters, the temperature in 1997 was 5 degrees warmer than in 1990, and increasing. You have to go back millions of years to find global temperatures like that. Dr. Thomas Crowley, a paleontologist climatologist, told the New York Times. Crowley painted a darker picture than Casey. Sea levels rising a foot and a half, flooding low-lying coastlines, while droughts devastated the torrid part of the world, Africa and Central America, as the agriculture in the northern hemisphere prospered because of the heavy rains. There were other changes, attributed to coal slippage, seen by Casey and detailed in his readings and conversations. The magnetic field which shields the Earth from solar and cosmic radiation had been weakened to the extent that it has become a vanishing shield, posing an increasing threat of mutations of plant and animal life and widespread climatic changes, contributing to global warming and malignant skin problems. Casey attributed the increased radiation to the uneasy axis moving gradually from its ice pack position. His assessment was supported by some scientists, with no thought, as Casey had, that the human spirit could turn things around. When the increased radiation became apparent, Dr. Keith MacDonald postulated that a concentration of heat from the solid inner core of the Earth increased fluid activity near the polar regions, slowly destroying the magnetic field. He saw a long period without an effective shield against excessive radiation, and then, as had happened in the past, for some inexplicable reason, the process would be reversed. Casey would have said it was explicable, a benevolent God at work. In the last 300 years, MacDonald says, the magnetic field with its ozone layer has decreased some 15%, with corresponding larger amounts of solar radiation reaching the Earth's surface as disturbances occur on the great gaseous ball of light around which our planet revolves. When this radiation reaches the Earth's atmosphere, it is trapped by the magnetic field which arches high over the Earth. These areas, the Van Allen belts, stand as a shield between the Sun and Earth, protecting plant and animal life from excess radiation. There may be a reversed series of climatic changes during the next few years. Lush valleys becoming barren wastes, deserts blooming, ice caps covering the land, polar caps melting, flooding the southeastern United States and other low-lying coastal areas of the world. Blue-eyed, fair-skinned people may have to stay indoors to shield themselves from the sun. Either that, or wear long-brimmed baseball caps and dark glasses that come down to the ends of their noses. Edgar Casey took a different view. It could all be turned around, he told Gladys Davis, his lifelong secretary, who jotted down every one of his readings. All we have to do is respect the Lord. He saw the best in every earth change he foreshadowed, she said, and would concentrate, meditating with Christ and the Lord, to hold back the solar winds and rays bombarding the earth. Casey short-circuited the scientists by his ability to tune in to the universal intelligence. Yet he did go over many of the explosive readings he gave, comparing them to what the scientists said about what he had to say, not troubling himself with their research into ancient records and paleontology. In not seeing the long-term ozone problem, Casey differed from the scientific mainstream, which saw the ozone hole or layer widening with the continuing pole slippage and the widespread use of chlorine pollutants. Meanwhile, New Zealand's Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research reported the ozone hole in the magnetic field over the Antarctic covered an incredible 10 million square miles of the stratosphere, affecting Australia as well. The ozone layer's thickness, the scientists reported from satellite data, was at near record lows, with 60% less ozone than some 15 years ago. Meanwhile, major newspapers in America, alarming their millions of readers while seeking to reassure them, were rolling out editorials urging the federal government to act promptly to protect the ozone layer in the North American stratosphere. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, already alerted by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, responded immediately in the decade ushering in the millennium. As NASA saw, the damage to the ozone layer was twice earlier estimates. Again, it was clear that thoughtless, greedy men in industry had self-inflicted with unbridled use of chlorofluorocarbons insolvents, air conditioning, and refrigerators. It never occurred to anyone that the chlorine gas used to kill hundreds of thousands of men in devastating wars could damage the ozone. Tests showed that a single chlorine atom could destroy tens of thousands of ozone molecules. It had taken a scientific team 20 years to figure out that chlorine, broken out of its compound by sunlight, was damaging the ozone layer. So it became an assault on two fronts, a weakened ozone layer and an attack of pernicious chlorine gas. There was a rush to cope with a problem that Casey may have applauded. Led by the U.S., 57 nations agreed to cut the chlorine use to half strength and to halt production of the noxious chemicals altogether by the millennium. The U.S. delegation to the Montreal Conference concluded that the ozone layer was essential to life on planet Earth. The Los Angeles Times noted that the ozone layer, monitored by scientists, had diminished 3 times faster than expected in 12 years, from 1985 to 1997. Scientists estimated that this could translate into 200,000 deaths from skin cancer in 50 years. Just before his death in 1945, Edgar Casey predicted the ozone problem would gradually fade away as the errant pole returned to its original home. Physicist McDonald gives the ozone layer another 2,000 years, with constantly diminishing protection from the sun, before the magnetic field fades out and another begins to take its place. Edgar Casey didn't look that far ahead. He saw the beginning of a rising consciousness that will bring man into millennial harmony with his God in the ceaseless struggle for survival and fulfillment. Casey summed it up as he had before. "As ye sow, so shall ye reap," was said 2,000 years ago by the One Who Comes Again. It was never more true than now, when His presence shall again grace our day. As for the sun, Casey was very much aware of its communication with stubborn, irreconcilable man, to whom he spoke in biblical language. "Be honest with thyself, as you would ask even the ruler of this earth, the sun, to hearken to the voice of that which created it, and gives its light irrespective of how ye act. For, as given, the sun shineth upon the just and the unjust alike, yet it is oft reflected in what happens to thee in thy journey through life. The more ye become aware of thy relationship to the universe and those influences that control man, the greater thy ability to help, to aid, the greater to rely upon the force within, but still greater, thy responsibility to thy fellow man. For as ye do unto the least, ye do it unto thy Maker, even as to the sun which reflects the turmoils that arise within thee, even as the earthquake and the wars and hates, even as the influences in thy life day by day. So what, you ask, are the sunspots? What do they have to do with us? Simply told, they are a natural consequence of that turmoil which the sons of man in the earth darken the heavens. Thus they bring confusion to those who become aware of the sun's closeness to God. Let not your heart be troubled, yet believe in God, then act like it to others. He has given thee a mind, a body, and a land in which to dwell. He has set the sun, the moon, the planets, the stars about thee to remind thee, even as the psalmist gave, "Day unto day uttereth speech, night unto night showeth knowledge." As what does thy soul appear? A spot? A blot upon thy sun? Or is that which giveth light unto those who sit in darkness, to those who cry aloud for hope? Hast thou created hope in thy association with thy fellow man? Ye fear and cringe when ye find that the spots upon thy sun cause confusion of any nature. How must thy Savior feel, look, appear, when ye deny him day by day, when ye treat thy fellow man as though he were as dross and trash before thee? The answer for man, Casey found, was simple. Shape up and know thyself. Chapter 5. World Affairs. Edgar Casey would have made a great Secretary of State. He had God the Creator as his Prime Minister and Jesus as God's spokesman. Communing with these advisors over the years, he had foreseen the end of godlessness in the two most powerful godless countries in the world, the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. When Casey said Russia will be the hope of the world, the Russian churches were shuttered, and Stalin, the Antichrist, had made it a crime for his millions of subjects to worship the Lord. Casey's followers sighed and shook their heads. But they reckoned without Casey's prime minister. Stalin, the despot who kept Russia in chains, died suddenly after World War II, some thought mysteriously, and the communist state began to unravel. Huge provinces like the Ukraine left the mother country, and the people, hiding their Bibles for years, renewed their worship of Jesus and the Father. Finally, the Iron Curtain was lifted. The new Russian government assumed ties with the West, and the threat of a nuclear war abated, with Casey seeing no such war well beyond the millennium. Casey went on with his prophecy. This hope was not as that termed of the communistic or the Bolshevistic, but of freedom, freedom, that each man will live for his fellow man. It will take years for the principle to be crystallized, but out of Russia, he repeated, comes the hope of the world. Guided, as Casey saw, by ties with the United States, that friendship with the nation that hath at its present monetary unit the expression, "In God we trust." Casey added a wry aside, "Do you use that in thine own heart when you pay your just debts, or in the prayer when you send thy missionaries to other lands?" He deplored the Japanese attacks in another generation on the Chinese mainland. Rather should the principles of the Christian faith be carried forward in and through the turmoils that are a part of both China and Japan. The Chinese could hardly appreciate this coupling with the country raining bombs on their cities. But Casey, as usual, held that the merchants of death were as much victims of the bombings as those who were killed, for this was something they would have to deal with for the rest of their lives. As China's trials and tribulations continued, with the Japanese extending their attacks, millions in an awakening China looked to a new God for understanding and help in dealing with the tragedies that befell them and their families. Casey suffered too, as his subconscious mind viewed the desolation and despair of the stricken. There seemed no end to the wars and power struggles ending finally in the triumph of the communists over the armies of Chiang Kai-shek, with a government, like its Russian counterpart, not paying homage to God. But China would awaken one day. Casey said, "There are those conditions arising from this great emptiness in the consciousness of many that will bring the revolution, bloodless, in the minds of many peoples, and begin that understanding of the gift of God in the one made manifest in the flesh." At a time when foreigners were taboo in China, Casey visualized its people cutting off the ponytails by which they were figuratively raised to heaven to join their ancestors, eventually becoming a force in world affairs and moving closer to Christianity. More than 60 years ago, he saw a country with more than a billion people wedded to Buddhism and Taoism, coming out of its isolation to one day contemplate, despite its communist leadership, the teachings of Jesus Christ. There was a growth of heart and mind, a powerful stream through a land which for ages asked to be left alone, to be satisfied with that in itself. Then it awoke one day and cut its hair off, the ponytails. It began to think of the world that had made itself felt, and it began to do something with its thinking. And with this thinking will evolve one day and become, as unlikely as it may seem, the cradle of Christianity as applied to the lives of man. Yea, it is far off as man counts time, but only a day in the heart of God. For tomorrow China will awake and know God, not the God of its fathers, but the God of itself, and will become a powerful force in the peace of the world. Some of China's growing bond to the Christian faith had been stirred by the racking pains of the Japanese attacks on its mainland, and in part by the bruising civil war in which the communists and Mao climbed to power. Who can forget the picture on the front pages across the world of a sobbing young mother holding the broken body of her small child in her arms amid the ruins of a city shattered by a Japanese aerial attack? Casey saw the advent of Christianity in China and its creed of forgiveness, easing some of the pain and bringing a new resolve to a nation that has yet to stretch its muscles to their full extent. A nation, he said, that would one day join with the U.S. in maintaining the peace. Casey became even more engrossed with China as he neared the end of his life. He was very much aware of the global potential of this giant of the Eastern world, intent, serious, hard-working, believing in themselves and country, as they chose a Christian life, even though the word Christianity itself would not be in approved usage for a good many years. Casey was questioned frequently about the Chinese, for that country traditionally had been viewed sympathetically by an America responding to the needs of children so often victims of famines and orphaned in wars that surged around them. He was encouraged by what he saw, a nation ever closer to God. Much might be said as to the various sects in China at the present time, but these will be united more and more towards the democratic way, just as it has begun, and it has been the last 20 years. And it will grow and spread faster in the next 25, and more in the last 5 than in the first 10. More and more will those of the Christian faith come to be in political positions, and this in China will mean the greater rule in certain groups, according to how well these manifest. And these will progress, for civilization and its influence moves west with the millennium. This was the old thesis of Casey's, the westward trend of the dominant culture, with the mantle eventually falling on the U.S., and intrinsically its westernmost state of California, which has become the world's leading communication center with a grip on the motion picture and television world. The sleeping prophet would have been pleased by reports coming out of the burgeoning China 25 years after his death in 1945, the year of his predicted ending of World War II. He had also predicted that China would open its doors to American political leaders, industrialists, and even the Christian clergy, not to mention President Nixon and a host of American reporters. One of these, James Scotty Reston, of the New York Times, appeared to be impressed by what he saw. Although the Chinese, the communist leaders, would be the first to deny that there are religious overtones in their propaganda and ideology, the similarities to the Protestant ethic are unmistakable. Every morning, a mimeographed report in English was delivered at Reston's door in a Beijing hotel, with a quotation from Chairman Mao Zedong, not only chairman of China's Communist Party, but of 1.3 billion Chinese men, women, and children. Instead of a corroding comment on the evils of capitalism, Reston was surprised to find a morality lesson, not as sweeping as the Ten Commandments, but still covering a wide range of human behavior. "We just learn the spirit of absolute selflessness," said Mao. "Diligence, frugality, and modesty. Remember these three." Enumerated were the 8 points for attention, each the equivalent of a commandment. 1. Speak politely. 2. Pay fairly for what you buy. 3. Return everything you borrow. 4. pay for anything you damage. 5. Do not hit or swear at people. 6. Do not damage crops. 7. Do not take liberties with women. 8. Do not ill-treat captives. Like so many visitors to China, Reston was impressed by the young, busily working in fields and shops, seeming to enjoy their labor in the oldest civilization in the world. He saw 1,000 young men and women cheerfully building a highway, digging the earth out of hills with picks and shovels, and carrying it in baskets to the new road. Everyone seemed to be enjoying what they were doing, building a new China they hoped would be theirs one day. The aboriginal lure for religion that would bring one closer to a super spirit, namely God, entranced the young Chinese, as it did the young in every land since Moses announced to his people there was a living God and he was one and all-powerful. Even more important than Mao, if you were to summon this reality and dared to voice it. Mao, being wiser than Stalin and Hitler, was not about to compete with God, as Casey saw, only angling to keep him in the background. Reston, an unusually astute reporter, looked deep into a young China's heart. He saw no religious fervor, only a quiet and steadfast resolve to make a better and stronger nation with a transcending belief in a higher power. It is something that enlightened Puritans like Emerson and Thoreau would have recognized at once. For the work ethic had many coattails, the principal one being the Creator, without whom there would be no coattails. Casey was intrigued by China, not only by its bigness, but its challenge to Christianity. As an ardent Christian, Casey would have liked nothing more than to see the Chinese as Presbyterians, his Sunday school class, Baptists, Methodists, or any other Christian church that taught the young to be dutiful and useful and keep all the commandments. He influenced many seekers to visit China, as he felt that America could have a moderating influence on that awesome giant and in return affect the visitors' religious and work ethic. Curious visitors poured into China, as Casey noted, from all over the world, some to help, others to observe and to learn. Some came because of Casey, intrigued by what he said of China becoming a landmark for Christianity. It seemed almost unbelievable, despite the corpse of Christian clergymen converting Chinese to Christianity before the communist takeover. 30 years after Casey's death, his prophecies were being played out by travelers looking for some signs of the Christianity Casey had laid out so plainly. One of these visitors, Dr. Kamers, a medical doctor from Ankara, Turkey, spent weeks during advanced medical studies in China looking into Edgar Casey's predictions of the growth of Christianity in the People's Republic. He found they were true. He was accompanied by another medical doctor and a nurse. They had been invited to study acupuncture, anesthesia, and therapy. "While doing this study," he said, "we naturally observed the moral, religious practices of the people in general." The nurse was my late wife, an American Catholic. The other doctor and myself were Muslims. We all believed in God and our religious teachings, basically the same as Christianity. The Chinese people he met, generally, said they did not believe in God, nor did they believe in survival after death. Yet their practice of moral ethics was high, higher than what we observed in the U.S., Europe, Muslim countries, and such places as Hong Kong, the Philippines, Japan, and Taiwan. They saw people invariably courteous to each other, kind and gentle. There was no noise in the streets, no trash, no fights or arguments, no beggars, no prostitution. They asked questions and saw that everybody was given work. Nobody was left hungry. Everybody had similar shirts, skirts below the knee, or trousers. They were clean and washed, not shredded at the knees like our blue jeans. The women didn't use makeup or lipstick. There was no sign of luxury. The doctor found them a friendly people. They talked openly about their religious convictions. He thought them contradictory. One day, I told our interpreter that even though you declare that you don't believe in God or the soul, you Chinese people obey God's teachings and practice religious rules, the most stringent in the world, stopping prostitution, giving everybody work to earn a living according to their abilities, practicing humbleness, wearing no sexy clothes, frowning on adultery, being unselfish and practicing brotherhood, advocated by Jesus and the Muslim faith. He believed the People's Republic was unique in its attitude about religion. It is the only country practicing religion among its people while not professing they are religious or believe in God. His relations with the Chinese medical fraternity in helping the sick were impressive. No act of selfishness or superiority toward my colleague and myself was evident, though our hosts were making major medical discoveries and offering them to the world. They were modest and taught humility. "Whatever we accomplished," they said, "we accomplished while seeking to relieve the suffering of patients." When we expressed our gratitude for what they were teaching us, they responded, "We are just exchanging views with you. We learn from each other. We are not teaching you anything. Make your suggestions. Tell us our mistakes so we can be more helpful to humanity." While appreciating the work ethic and the friendliness, Dr. Camus did see some cracks in the system. In China, if your personal ideas don't agree with the government policies, you may be sent away to work for years without seeing your family. There is no freedom of travel for people such as us without written permission. However, I believe some of these restrictions are due to economic difficulties. As the economy eases, I think there will be more freedom for recreation and travel. Many countries with economic problems have similar restrictions. But dwelling on these financial restrictions seems quite selfish, and so many people around the world are suffering from poverty, sickness, or hunger. There were greater imponderables, encompassing more than China. Like so many, Jess Stern ruminated over something Casey had said and what so many of us thought on different occasions. It was nothing earth-shaking, but it was about the core of life, and it did make one think. "What," asked Casey of himself, "what is life all about?" The author hastily turned the page and read on from the wisdom of Casey's universal intelligence. It was something he had heard many times, and that he would ponder anew. It said it all. "Thou shalt love thy God with all thine heart, thine soul, thine mind, thine body, and thy neighbor as thyself. The rest of all the theories that may be concocted by man are as nothing, if just these are lived. Love thy neighbor as thyself day by day, as did the Christ who died on the cross that others might live with him forever." It would have been a poetic ending, even if Casey had not added, "Know then that as he had his cross, so have you. May you take it with a smile. You can, if you will let him bear it with thee." Jess Stern wondered what Mao Zedong would have thought. Since the visit of the Turkish doctors, much has happened in China. The doors have been flung open to American business. McDonald's, the Hamburger King, has been allowed to open 40 stores in Beijing. Coca-Cola franchises are popping up in China's largest cities. The missionaries have been doing better. The Mormon Church, into the work ethic, conservative in approach to its members' lifestyle, has carved a niche of its own in a country where the work ethic is equally strong and frivolity deplored. Casey's subconscious wandered afar. It frequently turned to India, a land for which he felt a cord of sympathy because of its belief in reincarnation, which had become a cornerstone of his life and that of his family. Asked about India's struggle for independence, Casey stated that Gandhi, India's spiritual leader, had a greater force supporting him than all the English king's men. Non-resistance.